everyone, and welcome back to the Damage Report. Today, most importantly, let's start with the most important part. We have Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
That is the most important part.
Mm-hmm.
One more day. I've got my crystals to ensure that all the other negativity that might keep this man in the White House is gone. Mm-hmm. This one, I don't know what it does, and nor do I know what this one does. But the witch in the store said they were good, and I hope that it applies for this moment. Oh my God, we have one day left of this presidency.
It's, yeah, like I said in the pre-show, today is the last day of the Trump presidency. Isn't that crazy to be able to say that? Like, today's the last day. The last day.
I'm gonna puke. Like, that makes me so happy. Also scared. I'm just very nervous.
Are you nervous just in general? Are you nervous that today isn't the last day?
Both.
Yeah.
I am nervous that it's not the last day somehow. And I'm nervous for everything to come, but I'm also excited. Mm-hmm. And John, I'm sorry, I'm just making this all about me actually. But I wanted to show you, this is what I'll be doing once Trump leaves and everyone cries. I've got my new right wing tears mug.
Oh my God.
Dragon Squad.
It's for dragon tears, maybe.
Dragon tears only.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, I don't maybe the crystals will work to keep the dark psychic energy. I will say I have like hope. But also I don't know. I feel like uncomfortable. I feel really anxious. And I don't know if it's just because I'm not entirely sure that all the audio settings of my computer set up. So I'm worried that like a YouTube video of a board game review is gonna start blasting out of my speakers. But, or that something's gonna, I don't know. Like when I read the news that like a couple members of the National Guard are being pulled off the election security because of ties to militias, I'm like, oh no, that's like the movie. And so, yeah, I'm nervous. I want it to be the last day. I hope it's the last day. Proceeding as if it is, but very nervous about today. Very anxious, just feeling like. Anyway, thank you everybody for being here and basically providing crowdsourced free psychiatric care for me. Thank you for caring about my wellness. But you know, one other thing that would help it would be liking the stream and sharing the stream so that people know we're active. That would be delightful. Thank you in advance. We've got a lot of news that we're gonna be talking about through the course of today. Not only some of the potential last actions from Donald Trump as president, but some of the first actions that Biden is promising, some of which don't sound so bad. And then, you know, right wingers going crazy. And by the way, today is Tuesday, but as you can tell from Francesca being here, we couldn't do a show yesterday, so she's here today, which also means that our top 10 list for our YouTube tier 2 and tier 3 members will be recorded later after the show. It's going to be our top 10 formative political moments, some of the moments that we remember as having influenced our politics, the way we think about things, the way we engage with things. So it should be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. With that said, Francesca, you want to jump into this thing?
Let's do it.
Donald Trump over the last couple of weeks hasn't shown a lot of interest in really being president with his final days. But today, as we record this, it is the final day. And what is he going to be doing in addition to watching Fox News? Well, apparently he's going to be doing some pardons. We've been waiting. We got through the weekend without them. And now is the last day to just slip it as he goes out the door. The size and precise composition of the list is still being determined, but it's expected to be at least 60 pardons and computations, and perhaps more than 100. Now, who's on the list? We know a few suspected names. And the first, the one you're obviously thinking of, is Lil Wayne. Yes, Lil Wayne is apparently, no, seriously, he's apparently on the list. He's among those reportedly expected to receive a pardon or clemency. I hadn't known this, but in December 2019, he pled guilty just last month to, in December 2019, possessing a loaded gold-plated handgun when his chartered jet landed in Miami. He faces up to 10 years in prison.
Then storm the Capitol with that? Like, mm-hmm. 10 years, really? Like, I wanna know if those insurrectionists are facing that same time. It seems ridiculous, but also good on Lil Wayne. You know, we were all judging him. He knew exactly what he was doing by endorsing Trump.
Yep.
Yeah,
I know, like, I like to think that a lot of the audience you know, has an idea of what my values are, what I would stick to. If I was facing 10 years, I'd endorse whoever that you tell me got endorsed. 10 years in prison. I'm not made for 10 years. I'm not made for 10 consecutive minutes in prison. So I'll endorse whoever you want, but thankfully I don't have to. So I'm okay with that one. Others that are potential pardons, we have names that I honestly had forgotten. Sheldon Silver, former assembly speaker in New York on corruption charges. Sholem Weiss is facing 835 years for a variety of white collar crimes, I believe. And assume that that's the largest sentence ever for, you know, racketeering, fraud, all those sorts of things that they do. And so those I'm not super surprised by. These are people that hypothetically he might have known or worked with in New York. And they did the sorts of powerful, rich, white guy crime that he doesn't think you should get in trouble for. So I don't find these to be particularly surprising.
No, and in fact, the number of pardons and commutations is actually less than other presidents throughout history. But other presidents generally, you know, there's like a brother in there somewhere, you know, like the Clintons. There's personal favors. But usually they're also like someone who has been proven innocent by DNA evidence, but is still on death row. Or, you know, other like or nonviolent drug possession, etc. And instead, Trump's been also spending his last days murdering the people on death row, putting more people to death than any president in the last, I don't know, 100 years or so or more. Yeah. So yeah, it's what you would expect. The other thing that I'm like is that I'm just like, how is this not illegal? Is that apparently it's not illegal to lobby on behalf of your of the person you want out of prison or to be whose sentence you want commuted or whose crimes you want absolved or whatever or pardoned. And that's insane to me. Like you can not just that you can lobby, but you can pay money. You can
give money.
I think you can just straight up give money. Once again, the thing that we have to do in addition to all the things we have to do to Trump proof our democracy is make that illegal.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's terrible when that's happening with Trump. It's terrible also when it's happening with literally anyone else. Yeah, you should definitely be able to lobby. Like that's the only way that it's probably gonna come. But like the fact that you can give money is insane. The fact that you can just pardon your friends, just like the fact that you can pardon someone who helped to cover up your crimes. That's a lot about this is insane. A lot about this is insane. And so we don't have a lot of information about who's gonna be on the list. It's gonna be a lot of names and it's gonna be wild. Like this is our last day with Trump as president and everyone needs to ready themselves for some insane name. Are you sure that Tiger King isn't gonna be on that list? Are you actually sure? You need to look deep within yourself on this final day because like all of our naivete should have been burned away by now. I know I still have some, but like I don't know who he might end up pardoning today and I'm worried it's gonna be out of this world. But
Oh yeah, there's gonna be like we're talking Weinstein, Cosby, like the more P words you grabbed, the better. He's gonna be pardoning people who are safer in jail. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh
like that's the level of crime that they have committed. Yeah. And yeah, it is very much though a who's who of like all like look at the crimes. The crimes have something something in common, which is either they crimed on behalf of the Republican Party, they are Republicans themselves, or on behalf of Wall Street. So let's just remember when we talk about the swamp, when we talk about corruption, and when the right lobs that at Democrats, obviously they're not looking themselves in the damn mirror.
Yeah. Look, I think if I can make one prediction, I think posthumous Epstein. I think because they're very unfair. He's a guy, gets to be a guy. When you're wealthy, they let you do it. probably not, but are you 100% sure? Anyway, as we are trying to figure out who Trump is gonna be pardoning, one list of names apparently isn't up for consideration, they say. Sources who've spoken with the team say that the president won't pardon himself. Rudy Giuliani won't be pardoned. Steve Bannon won't be pardoned. Neither will members of his family get preemptive pardons. That is what they are saying. And I would say the fact that they're saying that makes me think, oh wait, they're lying to me to get my guard down and they're totally gonna do it. I could be wrong. And if I'm wrong, I'm gonna be wrong in like 3 hours. So it'll be a very fast turnaround. If Trump thinks there is a 1% chance that he can absolve himself of a big chunk of his legal, like the danger that's looming for his future, and the only thing that would stop him is it would look bad, that's not a thing to stop him at all. No. I don't think, Francesca. No. What do you think?
No, and it's just hilarious that like there's still like real reporting that's being like, but it has never been done and would be highly frowned upon. Like, yeah, that's why he's gonna do it. Like, what else is the point of being president for Trump unless it's a transactional, you scratch my back, I scratch yours agreement? Like, that is what he lives for, okay? He's purely transactional. That's how he's run his entire presidency. And if Rudy Giuliani doesn't get a pardon, you're telling me he was just working for whiskey and saltines this whole time? I don't think so.
Pretty much.
He's not getting paid the rate that he asked for. We know that.
Well,
so is it a pardon?
I think Rudy made a mistake, and it was he didn't work a miracle and get Trump to still be president. So like, sure, he was loyal for years to Trump, but he also failed. So I'm not 100% sure about that or about like Steve Bannon. Doesn't Trump hate Steve Bannon now anyway? But I think for him, even much more so than even for his kids, but I just think that if he can do it, he's gonna do it. But yeah, supposedly it's not gonna happen. Now, as you pointed out, one of the trends in his pardon record so far is that many of the people he's pardoned haven't shown contrition or remorse for their crimes. Few have argued that they were wrongfully convicted. Like, they're not even necessarily saying this was wrong, this was an injustice. They're just like, gimme it. That's the legal philosophy that's underlying it. But also for history, as you correctly pointed out, the fact that he's doing this 60 to 100 in the last day sounds really bad, and it is, but it's not bad because no one else does it. Barack Obama pardoned or commuted the sentence of 330 individuals on the day before he left office, mainly to low level drug offenders serving mandatory sentences. I'm gonna predict that that's not what Trump is going to do. Bill Clinton commuted or pardoned 140 people on inauguration day, which is even more suspicious, but in, you know, the history of it, they definitely shouldn't have, many of them should not have gotten it. George H.W. Bush pardoned a dozen people a day before leaving office. Ronald Reagan pardoned about 25 during his final week. So what Trump is doing is going to be insane and corrupt, but it's not gonna be without historic precedent.
No, and I mean, maybe it's a good thing that only 124 people were arrested from the Capitol attack, because there's a good chance those folks might also be pardoned. Like, I do not put that past this president. And I'm sure that all the like the boat dads and the children of boat dads and like the children of a Supreme Court justice in Brooklyn is definitely lobbying the president right now to try and get his son like off the hook, you know? Cause like, once again, any idea that that was like working class America, just, you know, who has been like left aside. No, it wasn't. These are tech CEOs and owners of companies. Yeah. And again, like privileged boat dads, okay? And yes, they are going to be sniffing for that little pardon poo.
But they're also, oh man, I don't know. Like, what does it say about me that on one level, I feel like that would be going too far. So apparently I'm still naive. And the other is that I sort of genuinely think the Epstein thing's more likely. I don't know, man. They just did it. It would look so bad. And think about, okay, that's not gonna stop him. But think about the effect it could, in theory, have on some of the Republican senators who are in a couple of weeks gonna have to potentially vote to convict him. If he inspires the attack and then legally protects with one of his final acts as president, wouldn't that put pressure on the Republicans to convict even more?
Right, you'd think. There's some weird machinations coming. Very interesting calculations on the part of Mitch McConnell, who's got, you know, Machiavellian, you know, brain mind. I don't know. I believe that McConnell actually does play 7D chess, and I'm very scared for what's to come. But yeah, it'll be an interesting few weeks.
Yeah, it's gonna be.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump has just hours left to be president, so what comes after? Well, one big tradition for presidents is the presidential library. And Trump apparently has ostentatious plans for his, perhaps even detached from reality. Two people familiar with internal discussions said it's likely to be located in Florida and run by Dan Scavino, one of Trump's longest serving and most loyal aides, who advises him on social media. But that's not the crazy part. It being in Florida isn't the crazy part. Dan Scavino is not the crazy part. Here's the crazy part, Francesca. One of these people, who is a top fundraiser on Trump's campaign, said the president has told supporters he wants to raise $2 billion for the library in small dollar donations from his grassroots supporters. Now, to put that in context, $2 billion for a Florida library, Obama's library in Chicago is $500 million, one-fourth the price. $2 billion for a man who I'm not sure can actually read. Seems like a lot.
Oh no, see, this will be the first library pictures only. We have every copy of Hustler's magazine without all those pesky words. That's really what the library is going to be. No, this is a grift. It's just like the inaugural committee. Like, it's the inauguration all over again. Dump the money into the so-called library, and it'll basically be like what the Daily Show was trying to make a joke, which was a library of presidential tweets. That's what it'll be. It'll just be tweets. It'll be 100 and what are we doing? 240 characters, 360. Mm-hmm. What is it up to now? These tweets. No, but it'll just be a bunch of tweets. It'll be all the things that he can't say, but you have to go in person to read about. Like, you have to be incited to violence through a book, which I feel like is maybe a step in the right direction.
That's a start. It's happened. Yeah, like they did that joke years ago. What has he produced? Like, he's not doing like long letters to foreign diplomats to establish a personal relationship, or he hasn't written. It's not his like law review, whatever they do. I don't know. Like, I'm imagining that Obama, for all of his faults, writes stuff and reads stuff, by the way.
Trump will pen a book. He'll pen a memoir. It'll be called Dreams of Mein Kampf. You know, it'll be great. Pillow. It'll just be like why I'm great when I second year when I was great as president. You know, I just feel for the ghostwriter.
Come on in, everyone. Every document has been rolled up and has personally spanked the presidential tush. That's the scale of library we're dealing. I guess if he can raise $2 billion. Like, he raised hundreds of millions to fight the election, which is a ton of money. Yep. But they're not gonna give 20 times more money for a shrine to stuff they hate, the written word. I don't see it. I don't see it. And I don't, I kind of want to see it though. Like, anyway, the fundraiser. This is one of the people, this person has raised money for Trump in the past, said, I thought to myself, what is this alternative fantasy life you're living? I have no clue where they think they'll get this money raised. Anyone who gives to him will be radioactive. Asked about raising money for the library, another former top Trump fundraiser said in a text message, insane. Except for the wackos, everybody's running for the hills.
Yeah, well, you've created a lot of wackos. I'm sorry, John, to cut you off, but
you're allowed to.
Like, oh, you'll be radioactive? They'll believe that. His supporters will be like, I'll be radioactive? Oh, hell yeah. I'm gonna give $5 right now. Radioactive. Like, no, it's an expression. Oh my God, maybe if you read, in fact, let's do create a library. Look, the library should just be free college tuition, okay? Let's be real. And also, just the tradition of libraries for presidents, like when W got a library, same thing, man. This guy's got no command of the English language, no respect for literature, history, anything. Why don't we just give the money to actual public libraries in different counties across the country? That would help.
Yeah. What would be in your presidential library?
Presidential library?
Nah. Like hypothetically, like presidents get to set up libraries. Mm. They're the only type of person where it's like, oh yeah, no, you make your own library. Mm. I want a library. I think that's a pretty good thing to give to people.
Yes.
I wouldn't fill it with tweets.
Mine would be like just lots of like soft ball pits, but no kids allowed. So it's like adult. it's adult story time, adult, like, you know, ball pit lounging. Mm-hmm. Do you lounge in a ball pit? Fun. Do you know what I'm saying?
I bet you could. But you could. You gotta relax the body. That's the thing. People start to flail, you sink to the bottom.
Yes. Some people and you can eat again. Everywhere. You can eat, you can talk. You still can't masturbate, sadly.
Noted. Anyway, okay. That was fun. Thank you. Let's move to something arguably as substantive as we transition to this next story. What is Biden going to do? Apparently, a lot. According to the comments that have been put out by his team, this next week or two is going to have a lot of action. So we will see. On Wednesday, right off the bat, following his inauguration, Biden will end Donald Trump's restriction on immigration to the US from some Muslim majority countries, move to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, and mandate mask wearing on federal property and during interstate travel. So we got other things. We're gonna go through a couple of different sets of things. These are the sorts of things that we've talked about in the past, Francesca, that he can very quickly do without, you know, going through Congress. Some of the big, most notable things that Trump did, some of which he did very quickly after becoming president, he can just reverse it. These are also, let's bear in mind, among the easiest things to do politically. So, but great, get back into the Paris Climate Accord and then start working on making it better and the Muslim ban. I think that's great first actions by Biden.
Yeah. Yeah, even when we're moving forward, we are still so far behind. So those are examples of things that, yeah, we should have done 20 years ago. And I am glad that, I mean, yeah, federal mask mandate, like, do we not have one after the super spreader event at the White House? Like, oh no, okay, still a petri dish. So, but again, I'm glad that he's laying it forward. I'm glad there's no like sort of self-flagellation around this, like lots of there. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of self-congratulation around things that are really, really basic. There's not a lot of fanfare. There's not a like, and we will create a mask mandate. Where's my cookie? Yeah. Which is good. I think it's head down and get to work.
Yeah. Other actions include extending the pause on student loan payments and actions meant to prevent evictions and foreclosures for those struggling during the pandemic. So that's good. We'll have more on COVID in just a second. My frustration is pausing or extending the pause on the student loan payments is good, but we had heard some talk about that possibly being accompanied by canceling some student loan debt. He never seemed interested in canceling all of it. And even some of the like set numbers, like 50,000, he seems to be put like Chuck Schumer's for that, but Biden's not. But Biden had talked about doing like $10,000 And in theory, he could do this as quickly and as easily and as, you know, unilaterally without Congress as some of these other things. But so far, it's not to say that he's not gonna do it. I haven't seen in these little preview puff pieces that people are putting together, I haven't seen an indication that that is in store for the first few weeks, which is disappointing.
For sure. And like you were mentioning, it's federal debt. Like, this is not something he's gotta go through Congress to do. And it's something that would be a huge stimulus to the economy, given how many people have student debt, and it's preventing them from moving forward, preventing them from buying a home, preventing them from doing so many things that would benefit the economy as a whole. So let's get on that. Let's get on him. There is there are a lot of initiatives and campaigns that are already lobbying Biden on this. So I think it's something that, like, maybe not in the first 10 days, but hey, the first 100, it could happen.
I hope so. Now, let's move to COVID, because that's the crisis that he had. Do people watching this remember that is still happening? Like, I feel like so many people are like, no, it's just whatever. That was like last year, 2020, man, that was rough. No, it's really rough right now. So on Thursday, Biden is gonna sign orders related to the COVID-19 outbreak aimed at reopening schools and businesses and expanding virus testing. Okay, good. If you're gonna expand testing, that's good. I gotta see what this reopening schools and businesses thing is. Maybe, like, that sounds like it's an order to cause it to happen. Maybe it will be new guidelines for when it should happen. But I am, like, just seeing it worded in that way makes me a little bit worried that he's going to try to have his cake and eat the establishment too, where, like, he puts more money into vaccines, but he also wants to reassure big business that he's moving us back to normality. Mm-hmm. So that is gonna be one that we're gonna have to look at very closely to see what the timeline he sets out for in terms of federal guidance for reopening.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really lump those two things together. I think we've like, calling schools and businesses the same is not true. I think businesses need money. They need money to stay closed. They need money to make up for what they've lost. They need rent relief. Schools are different. I think schools and teachers, I absolutely think there should be daily testing if we could do it, right? You know, you can daily testing of students and teachers. You can have limited class sizes, but it would be so important to so many families, so many communities, but you have to keep people safe. So I just, yeah, they're not the same thing. And I, you know, to be real with you, John, like, the people who've been trying to privatize the public sector schools and, like, public education are loving COVID, because they've been able to float all of their, like, online learning schemes. We're talking about Betsy DeVos's husband, of course, and herself, and all their cronies and their friends. And guess what? It doesn't work. It's bad. You have to have in-person learning. So I do hope there is a plan for reopening schools. I hope there is. I hope that that's next in line of vaccines and attention after healthcare workers and essential workers. And I hope that teachers and schools are in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope, like, it's not being talked about as something he's going to immediately do, although he says he's going to do it. And if you're going to do it, immediately sounds better. But the Defense Production Act for vaccines, like, yeah, our country has seemingly done a pretty good job of failing at this rollout. In our defense, we only had like 9 months to prepare for it. So why should we have been ready to make the vaccine and give it to people? Super complicated. Sounds like the sort of thing Kushner was probably in charge of. But anyway, if he can ramp up the production, that is one of the best ways that he can both protect lives in the near future. And also, if you actually want to reopen all of these things, there is literally no better way than getting people vaccinated. Masks was our best thing. And as a country, we decided, nah. Vaccines, though, could be even better. So if you're gonna do that, do it on the first day. If you're gonna make a dog and pony show? I don't know, some sort of big spectacle, yeah, saying, I'm gonna deploy the power of the federal government to produce as much of this vaccine as possible. He says he wants 100 million vaccinations in the first 100 days of his presidency. So far, that is not sounding likely unless he really helps ramp up that production, distribution, and all of that. Mm-hmm. Now, Joe Biden also has some environmental goals for the first days of his presidency. As we noted, he plans to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord almost instantly, which is fine. but it's not much, really, honestly. Like, the countries complying with the Paris Climate Accords is not going to be enough to get us to where we need to be. There are other things that he is going to be doing almost immediately. He has indicated plans to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline permit via executive action on his first day in office. The words rescind Keystone XL pipeline permit appear in a list of executive actions supposedly scheduled for day one. And man, that is like this thing that we are never gonna get past, is that damn pipeline, Francesca. But if getting him in helps shut that down, that's something.
That's huge. I mean, I think that is a giant win that belongs to all of the organizations that worked for years to lobby Obama and now Biden, and was sort of a dream dashed under Trump, you know, who was personally, I believe, invested. I think he got money from the owner of the Keystone XL pipeline, or the main investor of the Keystone XL pipeline. So it is a rapid reversal. And once again, this is like we move forward, but we're also sort of behind. But if it is an indication that this presidency will be turning away from things like dirty fossil fuels, tar sand fuel, like, I mean, just the most disgusting, the fossiliest fuel, and pipelines that run through this country that obviously the history of like their safety, how much they spill, how much they pollute, how much they you know, endanger every single community that they run through, all in order to like what? I mean, all that is, it's for export anyway. We don't remember this. And so this is why this is a first step. This is a first step toward the bigger goal, which for me, of course, is a Green New Deal. And really like making our country a leader, not in fossil fuel production, but actually in green energy.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I saw in advance of this, because it's expected that he's going to do this, one of the Canadian companies that's in charge of it is starting up plans to sell some of the pipeline infrastructure, since they're not gonna be able to use it. And that, just seeing that headline just feels pretty good after the time period that we've been through. Trudeau apparently is gonna fight to continue the project in some form. So great job, Trudeau. That's wonderful. Hope you're getting credit for how moderate you are and how you're trying to appeal to the business community or whatever as the world burns. Now this is, again, this is a good thing, but just because it's being reported that it's gonna happen, it still has to actually happen. And he's put out a couple of different lists of executive actions that are likely to happen. This isn't on all of them, by the way. So we're not saying this is a lock, and we'll have to see. He's already getting preemptive credit. People like Bernie Sanders tweeting out the Keystone Pipeline is and always has been a disaster. I'm delighted that Joe Biden will cancel the Keystone permit on his first day in office. With all the major crises facing America, we must never lose sight of the most existential threat facing our planet, climate change. But again, hasn't happened yet. Similar though, Reuters reports that early moves will indicate seeking to prevent oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is another one of these things where for apparently the rest of our life, we have to not have Republican presidents, because they're always going to move to develop there. And then hopefully the next Democrat stops it, but it's really just a holding pattern until eventually they get in there with enough time to just drill the hell out of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is why, once again, we have to keep pushing. I mean, for me, and I don't know whether, you know, I don't know if we're talking about this today, but I know you'll talk about it in the coming days. But for me, one of the biggest things that's been floated, and we still have to see because nothing's happened yet, in the first 10 days is laying out an actual framework for a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented people, for potentially giving DACA holders, dreamers, right, giving them green cards immediately. I mean, that is huge. That is a giant win. And that is thanks to, once again, the immigrant rights movement that's been pushing for this. But it is incredible if this presidency takes up that mantle immediately without caveats for the right, without we're gonna strengthen border security, without any of the language that both the left and the right, both Democrats and Republicans have participated in for so many decades when it comes to immigration. You all have effed this up for so long. There are 11 million documented people in this country. There are people who are DACA recipients who you've reversed course on. They deserve the ability to become full citizens. And it seems like he's gonna lay out even like a 6-year plan. not a 6-year plan, but like if you are living in this country for 6 years, you'll be eligible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like this is incredible. That to me is the ultimate win. And we'll see if he delivers on it.
Yeah. And in, you know, in like the zoomed out view of the overall approach of the administration to immigration, we're gonna have to see. Like there's things like they say, you know, the working on the reuniting of children with their families. That's good. And again, that seems like the most obvious thing that you would do. We're gonna have to see, like it post Trump, the Democratic Party's approach to immigration, what is that gonna look like? Because pre-Trump, it wasn't amazing. So and by the way, Biden is a pre-Trump politician who was involved in that. So we'll have to see. I just imagine though, like if I could be president, like you'd want front page news Thursday or like the late edition Wednesday, the $2,000 checks that were promised, you got Biden, you gave him the Senate, you're getting those checks. We're rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, okay? And hopefully working towards a Green New Deal. Like we're ramping up vaccine distribution. We're gonna get people vaccinated as fast as possible. The professionals are now in charge of the pandemic recovery once again. Like you could send so many signals to people about the most important crises that we're currently facing. And it sounds like he's gonna be doing some of it. Like imagine if he announced $10,000 student debt cancellation. Like the weight that would be lifted from the shoulders of millions of Americans, the stimulus effect that that would have in terms of those people being able to use that money out there right now would be so good for those individuals and for business. Like there is a great day one. And I think he's prepping a pretty good day one. But we'll see. We're not there yet. We still gotta get through today. This is the sort of devastating news that in an earlier time would have perhaps made our meanwhile in segment. But now I think it deserves singular focus. And that is that while we have been rightfully frustrated with the rollout of vaccines here in the US, it is a far, 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 far worse situation outside of countries like the US, Canada, UK, Germany, that sort of thing. The world is, according to a report by The Guardian, on the edge of a catastrophic moral failure in the distribution of vaccines, with just 25 doses administered across all poor countries, compared with 39 million in wealthier ones, according to the head of the World Health Organization. Not 25 million, not 25,000, 25, like everyone in all of those countries who's been vaccinated could stand in the background of my shot right now. That's insane. And that is, it's even worse than that because it's just one country. Guinea is the sole low income country to have delivered any shots. Last week, it got a few of the Russian Sputnik vaccine. Its president got one and 24 other people. And I'm assuming that even in this poor country, it's probably not the poorest people who are getting it. Francesca, 25 shots. It's been weeks. It's been like a month now, basically. 25 shots in one country.
I mean, I'm not surprised. But I know that there are other countries that are, I know, for example, Argentina, where I used to live, they have been rolling out the vaccine. So it's not the entire global South. It's not all of, you know, but yes, the countries that are perhaps the poorest, the most in need, that they have not gotten it. And I know we're gonna go into sort of the politics of that and like the pharmaceutical company's responsibility. But I just wanna say that this is what happens when, you know, we have global powers that abdicate any kind of responsibility for the rest of the world. Like we've spent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years pillaging these nations, and then we'll just build walls when any of those folks who are trying to flee the nations that we have devastated want to come into our country. And so you can draw a line, as we have this entire time, between COVID and climate change. You know, we know that there's such thing as climate refugees, and there is such thing as COVID refugees, right? There will be people who need to leave and are trying to leave because Their countries are not handling this health crisis and are not able to handle this health crisis well. And so the more we invest, if we are a globalized world, the more that we invest in countries with no strings attached, with no regime change strings attached, you know, the better it is for everybody. And so not to go back to the immigration stuff, but I know that one of Biden's points in his plan to tackle immigration is also increasing the funding to countries in Central America that have been devastated, that Trump has ripped money out from, but that we know goes a long way to making sure that people don't have to migrate in the first place. So just to draw that comparison there.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, what you were talking about is like, it's one of the classic contradictions in the way conservatives see the world. It's, I want to be protected by things, and so I will think no farther than the closest wall I can set up. And I will create a literal hell on the other side. I will guarantee that there will be disturbances and chaos and war and all of that. But I will be at least temporarily really safe inside of my little community with people that look and think and worship exactly like me, rather than trying to increase the quality of life of everyone so that it's not like that. We could have spent 6 months setting up, because you know, like they say, like it's really tough to make a lot of vaccines because of supply chain. Okay, well, you could also be setting up for that. We could have spent 6 months prepping for that, to not only distribute so much of the vaccine that we could vaccinate our entire population very quickly, but become a world leader in shipping the vaccine to other countries. Mm-hmm. And I know that, like, well, obviously that's never gonna happen under Trump. And that's true, but hypothetically, if you want American businesses to do very well, American businesses don't just interact with Americans, okay? They require people to not be engulfed by a pandemic worldwide. If we all get vaccinated and that's where it ends, and maybe the UK does pretty well, and Germany and Israel, and that's pretty much it, that is going to be terrible. Even if you don't care about the human cost, just the business cost for that is going to be devastating. To put it in perspective, there's 25 shots. This is insane, but Classic Tech said this on Twitch. 23 shots, it's actually 25, but 25 shots is less shots than what's available in the song Shots by LMFAO. They say the word shots in that song more than the number of shots all of these countries have gotten.
Oh God.
Insane. Now, let me give you a little bit more information about that. Israel, Bahrain, and the UAE have delivered the most doses per capita, with more than 1 in 4 Israelis having received a dose of the Pfizer formulation. That's amazing, actually. That is very big progress for a month in. Just over 6% of people in the UK have received, and by the way, in Israel, I just imagine what that's leaving out. Anyway, just over 6% of people in the UK have received a vaccine dose, along with 4% of US citizens. So we've gotten to 4% in the US. That's probably better than I would have guessed it's at right now, based on how many issues there have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give you one last update on the COVID situation here. Let's jump ahead to the graph. The number of deaths, at least for the weekend, where it's always the lowest, is a little bit down in the US at about 1400 deaths. You can see in this chart that the number of hospitalizations is starting to go down a little bit, a few thousand. Of course, that is partially because a percentage of those people have since died. Regrettably, but it looks like the cases are starting to go down. They're still at catastrophic levels. The cases are starting to go down, hospitalizations are going down. That usually preludes the deaths going down a week or two later. So
I don't know, John, if you're gonna throw this graphic up or not, but I think that this one really important piece of this story is that India and South Africa are trying to get the World Health Organization to waive intellectual property rights for the COVID-19 vaccine. But of course, the United States, the UK, Canada, and all the pharmaceutical companies that are based in there and that have been making incredible profits from selling their vaccine to these, so-called first world countries, are resisting that. And I think that is, again, what happens when not only you divest or straight up leave the World Health Organization, like the Trump administration did, but you also spend years underfunding it. And this is the kind of work that, like, we talk about pharmaceuticals, we talk about the price of, pharmaceuticals, and then, let's not lose the thread now that they are our saviors, right? They know that they're our saviors. They know they have everybody by the balls, so to speak. And now when you have countries like India or like South Africa that are like, please let us create, our own vaccines that don't have your IP or whatever, then there's resistance. And the same goes for HIV and AIDS, right? And that epidemic. And, hate it, love it, whatever, but something the Clinton Foundation actually did that was good, was helping to get HIV medication that was far cheaper because it skirted and was an affront to the intellectual property rights around those around that treatment. So yes, this is a fight that it has long, long, long roots and a lot more future when it comes to pushing back on these big pharma companies.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully, like we wanna check in with this. Because hopefully with Biden coming in, it won't just lead to a quicker pace of vaccinations here, but you know, they love to tout their, you know, diplomatic background, you know, the accomplishments of the Biden years. Well, or the Obama years, this is a great opportunity to deploy that and hypothetically save a lot of lives.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, let's move right on into a little bit of lighter news to close things out than that. Let's check in with how the right is processing this final week, the transition between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. This is Ainsley Earhart. It's a very short clip. I just think it's amazing her defense of Donald Trump in these last days. As we've seen more and more Republicans moving away from him, here is the defense of Donald Trump.
You know, they'll criticize President Trump, but no one can argue he is a worker. You know, he doesn't drink alcohol. He stays up late at night. He watches every show. He's working. He got to work immediately.
So every part of that is good. But Francesca, he watches every show. She said that. That's a thing she said.
And that qualifies as work?
That was one of them. Like she said, he does the work. Okay, brain. Now I need evidence of that. He watches every show was one of the first three things that she came up with to prove that he works. Is he watches every show. That's not a good defense of like your kid's attention span or anything, let alone the present. What does that have to do with anything?
Yeah, or that he doesn't drink. He's like, you know, is that just like, you know, most people watch this show. You gotta be real drunk to really understand what we're talking about. I'm drunk right now, but the president does not drink. And that, I mean, that's work.
I watch too many shows. I'm just an idiot on the internet. I watch too much. Like, did I need to watch the entire first season of Jeff Goldblum's show on Disney Plus? Did I need to? No. I would make the case yes, but we can disagree about that. Him, if he had not watched a single show as president, it like from my point of view it would have been bad because he would have gotten a lot more done. But she, that's just a message to Trump. It's like you're a very good boy. You watch all the news. What a good special child that you watch Fox and Friends. And the thing is, it's not a new thing from her. So this is from October. Barack Obama had criticized Trump in the run-up to the election, saying that sure, he wasn't ever gonna, you know, follow my legacy or anything, but I assumed that he would at least do the work. He hasn't shown any interest in the work. This is what Ainsley Earhart said to that.
Well, people that do work in the White House would argue against that. They would say he does work. He works 24/7. He held 9 rallies in the past 8 days.
But again, that's not, what does she think the president does? Makes TV, watches TV?
Yes, I mean, yes, that's exactly what the president, I think you just nailed it, John. It once again, this is the human centipede of right-wing politics and media. That's all it is. And Ainsley, I feel bad for, because it's like, if he had gotten 4 more years, she would have been the next press secretary. You know, we're running out of blondes, funneling the blondes. And you know, those who can lift one eyebrow like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I can't quite do it. But that I think is the barrier to entry. Look, she's gonna have a great future as the head of the Donald Trump Presidential Library.
Maybe. I know that like it's a message to him and that's what he wants to hear. And it's like if you're a right winger, and this is what you're consuming. And like that, she's not Laura Ingraham or Tucker Carlson. Like you watch Fox and Friends and you think, oh, it's like a morning show. It's just a light thing. But you get it drilled into you that the work of government is this stuff on Fox. It's watching the stuff on Fox. It's creating stuff for Fox to talk about. The work of government is not identifying and fixing problems. It is talking. obsessing over cultural stuff and working your audience into a fervor over it. Yeah. That's basically what it is. Do not have any expectations for government beyond that. They're not gonna help you. They're not gonna get you a job back. They're gonna talk about how someone stole your job. They might talk about that. And it's that sort of evasion where it makes it, sure, you watch this video and it's her like sort of looking like a clown, but that is part of a worldview that they have indoctrinated millions and millions of Americans into, where the highest aspiration of politics is to make the other side cry. Yeah. And that's really it.
Yep.
Anyway, let's transition to one last thing. It is admittedly way too early to be thinking about who hypothetically might be running in the Republican primary next time. But some people make it abundantly clear that that's what they're planning for. If you're one of those lucky individuals who's been following Secretary Pompeo on Twitter, they have just been posting like PR stuff for him the last couple, like it has nothing to do with his job at all. So here's an example, and you tell me what this really has to do with being Secretary of State. Here's one of the last tweets that will ever go out from his time as Secretary of State. Wokeism, multiculturalism, all the isms, they're not who America is. They distort our glorious founding and what this country is all about. Our enemies stoke these divisions because they know they make us weaker. Which is a different quote than the quote in the image, which is censorship, wokeness, political correctness at all points in one direction. Authoritarianism cloaked as moral righteousness. Well, a cloak of moral righteousness is really what that tweet is all about. So Francesca, what do you think?
I mean, I woke up to this Nazi-ish. Like, I am sorry. Like, you, like, oh my God. What I think this means is that when he does announce his run in 2024, he will use the N-word. Like, it.
Because if he doesn't, it's authoritarianism.
If he doesn't, then it's just all this political correctness. Exactly. It is not being a Nazi is Nazism. Do you see how this works? Like this, I mean, what an embattled majority that we have elevated and we have deluded an already majoritarian, like white, straight, you know, elite, you know, cabal. Like they have deluded everybody that like white genocide is real and that you not being able to say all your favorite slurs. Mm-hmm. Also, why do you have favorite slurs? Is somehow like is authoritarianism? I mean, like, yeah. I can't believe this stuff. Like the idea, and let's just name it. Multiculturalism and being against that, that is the stuff of far right pseudo populist movements all throughout Europe. This is Steve Bannon stuff. This is, you know, yeah, Nigel Farage stuff. This is Golden Dawn in Greece stuff. This is all the stuff. And like, that's in Europe. That's in Europe that's like been experiencing more waves of migration now. Whereas the United States, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, man. It was like, we are a melting pot. We are a little mixed salad. You're a tomato, I'm avocado. Like, it's just like, it was.
Not a real song, or did you just make that up?
I just made it up. But like,
good freestyle.
Dude, I'm telling you, I have multicultural freestyle whenever you want. So
that's not what this show is about, okay? Your freestylisms. Yeah, no, you're 100% right though. The saying multiculturalism is not what America is about is, sure, it's like the intro to a Tucker Carlson monologue. But in terms of actual politicians, that's Steve King. Like 5 years ago, were there four Republicans that would have just tweeted, no, I'm against multiculturalism.
Yep.
But now that's just ground floor. I want to run in the primary. So I need to let you know that I think we should only have one culture. Any of them's fine, I'm sure. Just pick one of them at random. But no, that's, and wokeism. Because the Republicans, I'm going to say, do they encapsulate 99% of the actual uses of the word woke in the last year? It's like, yeah, they're the only person that are talking about that. But yeah, get ready for that primary, because we had some really nasty debates in 2016. Ooh. You know, like, who believes in global warming? Would you let someone die on the street, you know, because they don't have health insurance? But they are going to be even more explicitly fighting each other in a battle royale to prove how heartless, cruel, fascistic, racist they are.
Get ready for Jake Tapper to be like, so with the wokeness, are we talking, would you agree with Secretary Pompeo that they need to all go to work camps? Go. Like this is the normalization that is coming from the US media. I'm like, do not let this happen, y'all. I'm still not over the ways that mainstream media normalized Trump, and every single debate was, yeah, but what do you think of Trump's idea? Like, this fool should not be running. This fool is a joke. The wall. So, but it'll happen. It'll happen. And I, unless we get better executives, I'm not holding my breath, but then nothing's gonna change.
Oh God, it's gonna get dark. It's gonna get so dark. Just ready. Like, we've moved into a time of more possibility. But all the right's gonna lose it. What the media is gonna be saying, what their politicians are gonna say. Like, Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene got elected. There are so many Republicans that wanna duplicate that right now.
But this is why we need multiple parties. This is why we need proportional representation. This is why, you know, when you say the Golden Dawn or you say these European like fascistic, you know, parties, like, yeah, but they have like proportional representation. They have parties. They have multiple parties, not just two. So really the onus is on Republicans. What are they gonna do? They're gonna cut these crazies loose? They're gonna form a new party? Is Bloomberg gonna lead the way? I mean, honestly, though, this is we're in a very interesting moment.
I'd forgotten about Bloomberg's run. Hello and welcome to our top 10 formative political moments. I'm Johnny Arola. Francesca Fiorentini is here. How's it going, Francesca?
Hey, I'm excited for this one.
I know. When I said it to you, it just sort of like hit me. I was like doing the rundown last night. I was thinking, what's a good one that's like sort of political, but more personal? Some of them are just sort of political. And I thought this could be a fun one. It's tough, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's both tough to literally put together a list, but it's tough to know what it is that really has had the most lingering impact on you. So I did my best to put together some different things, but if you would ask me on any day, the answers could be totally different, I bet. But anyway, if you're watching this, it's because you're one of our YouTube tier 2 or tier 3 members. Thank you so much for continuing to support the channel and getting access to this, as well as all of our past top 10s. We've got like at least 5 now. The last one was my top 10 board games of all time. A lot of fun there. And so this one's slightly more political. Francesca, would you like to go first with your number 5?
Yeah, I mean, so this is formative for us as people, right?
Like something that's really informed or changed or started your political thing.
Okay, my first two are related. I've got a lot of.
We're probably gonna have some overlap here, maybe.
We're probably gonna have some overlap. But like, yeah, like if we can get personal rather than making it formative, I was gonna be like, NAFTA is a big one that has reshaped our entire like world, my world, my life. But I definitely will say the election of George W. Bush in when I was not able to vote yet, but on the cusp of being able to vote, and the then rapid descent into like demagoguery and war and giant media consensus. I don't know, there's just like a dark period when Bush was elected. So, but my number one, maybe, I guess my first one isn't Bush, but it is, I would just say 9/11. Let's just say 9/11. I was in New York when 9/11 happened.
Oh, wow.
I was just a freshman in college. I went to undergrad at NYU, and that was so formative to me. And everything that came after it and the reaction of our government when I was in a moment where I thought, well, surely we're gonna figure out who did this and like hold those people accountable, not bomb two countries. Yeah. So kind of 9/11 and the war on terror and coming of age when you understood that your government was not very much not good, very much not the good guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that all happened under George W. Bush. So that's sort of an amalgamation of one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I theoretically might have that higher up on my list, so I'll mostly talk about it there. But yeah, okay. when you realize for the first time as a kid, when you realize that things can be bad.
Yes.
Like, and it doesn't have to be politics. Like, I don't remember which movie, but like learning that movies can suck. Like, you just assume as a kid, well, they wouldn't have made it if it would suck. They wouldn't put all this money into it. No, sometimes they just make stuff that sucks, actually. And they make governments that suck too. Most of them, actually. Anyway, my number five is a little bit different. My number five is Bernie Sanders' first run for the presidency. Because at this point in 2015, I had been paying attention to politics for a decade and a half or whatever. I had been covering politics for a few years, but it felt very sort of arm's length. Mm-hmm. Like at this point, by the time I started doing political stuff in the media, I already knew who Obama was, and I knew that he wasn't like fully 100% my guy politically. We didn't agree on a lot of stuff. But then Bernie ran, and it was so exciting. Like he said the things I wanted him to say for the most part. He had the positions I wanted him to have. He was unabashed in differentiating himself from Hillary Clinton. And the movement that sort of built, I think for a lot of people, that was very important. Not necessarily in our age range, but maybe a little bit younger. It was just a very exciting time in politics that seemed to have a lot of potential.
Yeah. I can skip it. I think we must have similar ones, but I just want to add to that like it was the first time for me where I felt like, oh, you don't have to be evil to run for president, mm-hmm. Or you don't have to be sort of like a shrewd, conniving, like, or a perfectly spoken or a perfect looking, politician in order to win. And so, or in order to run, and you can actually run on your real values, not just sort of like the values that have been, lab tested and crowd tested. Like that, I think he showed a way, especially for a radical like me and someone on the left, that electoral politics absolutely matter. As someone who's mostly focused more on issues and cared more about like what's happening at the grassroots and the structural stuff, they're like, hey, you can talk about the structural stuff and also still make a really, really solid run at the White House twice.
Yeah. 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 And both of them for different reasons. And
yeah,
really, it really felt at the end there in the second one that he was going to win. Anyway, that's my number five.
Nice.
What's your number four?
Oh God, okay, number four. This is very difficult because these are all again blending together. But number four related to my number one about 9/11 was when Bush was reelected. So I just want everyone to imagine, and this was the same fear that I was having before this election, that Trump would be reelected. The power of an incumbent is huge, and yet at the time, I was a young anti-war activist who thought, look, the war is going horribly in Iraq, right? It was based on a lie. Now it's going horribly. The world knows that this is awful, and the American people don't want this war anymore. 2004, right? No, they absolutely were fine with more war. And more importantly, the Democratic Party put up John Kerry as an alternative to George W. Bush, someone who not just lacked, the any kind of political pizzazz or interest or intrigue, but really tried to run on a platform of I'm gonna do the war on terror better than George W. Bush, which was ridiculous. I remember going to watching debate parties where he would be like, I'm gonna get Osama, and then everyone, all these Democrats would be like, woo, and it's like, is that the language we need to be putting out right now? Is that really an alternative to Bush? You're just saying you'll do Bush better? You're saying you'll do the war on terror better? I think I think the whole thing is premised on a lot of BS. So I would say that was formative, and the way that, and I think a lot of young activists and a lot of young leftists need to learn this lesson, is that just because you feel like you're in the moral right, and just because you are in the moral right, doesn't mean that there is a political will or even a populace or a population that's going to vote the right way. And that takes so much more work, sadly. And just being right about something is not gonna make it happen.
More in this area to come. Yeah. My number four is, and this is gonna seem like a weird one. This is a much more specific thing. A lot of mine are fairly broad. My number four is the 2004 Democratic National Convention, the keynote speech. Do you remember it, Francesca?
No.
It was the keynote speech. It was by a young politician by the name of Barack Obama.
Yes.
And I still remember sitting in a dorm watching that speech, and I got hyped. Like, it was, yeah, it's the political speech of my life. Yeah. The reason it's my number four, though, is that it maybe shouldn't have been. Like, I guess to the extent that I could at that point in my life sort of fall in love with a politician, I was down for Obama when I heard that speech. I was like, yes, tell me more. And I hadn't yet really gotten that, oh, they cannot deliver, or maybe not even totally mean it. And so I got so into him that, you know, in 2008, I was ready to go in the primary. At that point, I was in grad school. I still remember like all the campus debate about which one of them should win. But it was that moment that really launched me into like being down for Obama. And I had to learn a lot over the course of that whole process. Good speech, though. Damn good speech.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, I cried mostly because Bush was out. Mm-hmm. And I definitely took to the streets to celebrate Obama winning. But then I was also like, he's going to disappoint us. And my friend was like, shut up, just shut up and enjoy it. And I was like, but he's not really what we need. Shut up. Yeah. I definitely am someone who's to the left of Obama. But yes, you cannot deny being inspired by that. And I mean, I don't believe that our politics should just be this pendulum that swings back and forth, but like it was really interesting that like after 8 years of Bush, people are gonna vote in the first black president. Like that is not insignificant. And also, if we had 4 more years of Trump, would we have gotten Bernie? Probably not. I don't wanna dabble in that kind of accelerationist thinking, of course. Let's see, political moments, top formative political moments.
Number three.
Number three, which is in no real order for me. It is really, it's a hard one. But I will say that like your first concert, your first demonstration is something that you never forget. And whether your parents brought you to a demonstration when you were little, but when one of my first demonstrations was against the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, and like just I got politicized through the global justice movement, which again, for a reminder, was sort of against like endless free trade, American corporations everywhere. By the way, spoiler, we lost that fight. There is a McDonald's everywhere. And, you know, but I think for me, a political moment was, it's so politicizing when you finally take to the streets, when you join with your fellow Americans, when you stand in solidarity with people and you actually exercise your First Amendment right. And you realize this is why we live in this country. And also, we're not that free. Like, I've been arrested twice. Once I was deliberately arrested as a direct action, and once I was just on the sidewalk and didn't want to be arrested. So it is also a politicizing moment to protest and see that, oh yeah, these guys don't care. These riot police don't care about my freedom of speech at all. Unless you're a white nationalist, in which case, go right ahead.
Ooh. You should have been a Proud Boy at that point.
Yeah, but yes, I think you're
the 2003 era Proud Boy.
God, your first demo is always politicizing. I was arrested outside of the United Nations when the Iraq War started, and Hans Blix was presenting his evidence to the UN, and I was screaming at the cameras as they were hauling me away. I don't know where it is, and I was just like, the UN has a responsibility, and I was just like, wearing my Carhartt pants that I had to clut the sides of because Carhartt aren't meant for women with hips or get it. So
I'm just glad that the first footage of you isn't like jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
No,
maybe it is for some people.
Anyway. I had to organize with not some some of the people I worked with then went on to be like 9/11 truthers, and I was like, oh God.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. But yes, being arrested, getting and taking to the streets, I think is really, everyone should do it. Do it.
Yeah. My number three is going to be, I don't want to speak definitively and spoil the rest of the list, but it's a recent one. And that is the experience of the lockdown. I think the pandemic is pretty a big one for a lot of reasons. For me though, it's not much to do with the government, really, a little bit. I had some lingering hope that as troglodytish as Trump and his administration have been, that they would still, surely they would stop half a million people from being killed by the end of this, surely. So there was a little bit of waking up to that. Like even after years into Trump, thinking, well, but there's still some base level that the government has to function, right? Mm-hmm. But mainly it's a process of getting to know what millions of your fellow Americans are actually like. Mm-hmm. And they're awful in a lot of ways, sure. And we've known that for a long time. But the anti-mask stuff, those protests, I feel like if you can get people against protecting themselves from a virus, I don't know what meaningful thing you can't get them on. Like that's the lowest a society can go. People protesting for their right to infect people with a pathogen. Yeah. And that happened very recently. And I'm still processing it. And that's now. They're getting crazier in the QAnon stuff. So I don't know what that looks like in 5 years. But we are a country that has, you know, Bernie, and it has people who think coughing in a Trader Joe checkout person's face is the most important exercise of your rights as an American that you can possibly pursue. So the lockdown is still ongoing, obviously, but that's was pretty formative in a number of different ways.
My God, that's a good one. That is a very good one. Yeah, we're a sick country, and it took an actual virus to expose just how sick we are when it comes to our idea of what freedom really means. One of my moments is definitely living outside of the country, but I don't want to make it, it's not like a moment like specific, but I just want to encourage everyone when you travel to try and do that. No, but yeah, okay, let's make it a moment. I lived in Argentina for 5 years, and I've never felt more free. I'm an American, grew up here, but I've never felt more free than when I lived in another country. Why? Because the government that currently was in power when I was there, not Macri, not the current government, but the Kirchner government, had a policy of like zero repression when it came to protests. And so you could take the streets and lock down and like march, and like they didn't shoot rubber bullets at you because the previous administration had been so horribly repressive. And so I've never felt freer. I was like, oh wow, freedom of expression. You're not getting you're just not running from tear gas right now. And that I think was really formative to see how other countries actually are better at protecting human and civil rights. And related to that, you know, we're talking about a country that suffered dictatorships. And in my mind, I felt like the closest thing I could see to a coup was really the George W. Bush presidency that he didn't win, right? That was decided by the Supreme Court, that was a coup. And there was an absolute consensus once again in that time from, there was no, you know, there was no resistance. There was no hashtag resistance even, right?
There were no hashtags.
There were no hashtags. The media was completely in lockstep with the march to war with George W. Bush. That was Cheney. You know, they did fascism smart. And but for me, like living in a country that had a dictatorship and then seeing the ways that they, as soon as this new president came to power, they took down the photographs and the paintings and portraits of the former military dictators, of the military junta and what that meant. And then they continually reminded people through advertisements, through public awareness, that we're never going back. Nunca más, we're never forgetting. We know what the dictatorship was like, and we fight for memoria, right? They would always say, we're fighting for memory. Let's never forget the 30,000 disappeared. And I think that we need that in this country, whether it's slavery, whether it's the Bush administration, whether it's the 400,000 and counting people who are dead from COVID. Like, let's have more public consciousness, and I hope that's something that the Biden administration does, is like, let's remember, let's not be afraid to look back and be and say that was our past. You know, Confederacy's dead, y'all. You know, like we are not forgetting that past, but we're learning from it. So anyway, that's a very long moment, but no, it was very formative for me.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I wonder about what effect in that area the Biden time will have. I feel like one of the positives of the Trump era was a lot of people waking up in a bunch of different issue areas. I think that was really big in terms of the environmental movement sort of returning after being gone for 15 years or whatever, or in terms of its actual influence.
Yeah.
My number two is actually one of your earlier numbers. It's Bush getting reelected because. Yeah, the 2004 campaign was the first presidential campaign I followed. And so the first candidate I supported was Kerry. Just so unsatisfying. In the primary, I was originally for Howard Dean.
Hell
that
yeah.
Went well. And I might have at one point liked who's the awful guy with the nice hair? Edwards. Yeah, but
first of all, I liked Edwards except for when he cheated on his wife with cancer, etc.
Cancer.
But Kucinich was running in 04 too, remember? Remember Dennis?
Yes, he seemed
a little too left for you?
No, it's not that necessary. I just wish someone else had been delivering the message. But anyway, because we'd been years into the war. And it was really not going well.
Not going well.
Think, and you know, that's years of campus demonstrations against the war, international demonstrations against the war. He was just doing so badly. How could he possibly get reelected?
Yep.
And then you had the Swift voting, and Kerry's like, oh God, Kerry. But like seeing a president who had no right being reelected. And in the way, and being so afraid of what it signified, like 4 more years of Cheney, 4 more years of the Patriot Act, 4 more years of all, like we're going in the wrong direction in so many different ways. It was just a horrifying experience, and I was shocked that it could happen.
Someone committed suicide outside of the World Trade Center Memorial when he was reelected. I remember that.
It
seemed like
time.
Very much a political protest. Yeah, it was a horrifying time. And things did get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Things absolutely.
And then the economy fell apart. Like what's actually worse? Our predictions were not wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number one. And it's fitting that we're in a moment, and we're fitting that we are in this moment where we're saying goodbye to him. But of course, the election of Donald Trump. And I think everything that it has meant, but more importantly, it's the how. It's how he was elected, how he was inflated by the media. And then once he was in office, how we were unable to safeguard against his worst instincts, and how our democracy that's clearly set up more on norms than on actual rule of law can just crumble when someone wants to come in there and be a demagogue. And so it revealed just how fragile our democracy is, but it also revealed just how many go along MFers there are, both in the media and in democracy and in DC itself, which is like, oh, as long as you play by these rules, you could be a Dick Cheney. You know what I mean? So I guess what I mean is, like, what I'm trying to say is it would have been so easy for him to have been able to lull and seduce DC and the media, but he didn't, and yet he was still able to get away with what he did. So it's like, I just feel like it was such a failure, such a letdown for all Americans that we allowed someone like that to assume office and then weren't able to properly protect the actual institutions of democracy from his worst instincts. And I also think just revealed the Democrats as well. I mean, Obama meeting with him the day after, it's like, or you know, a couple days after, I get it. Like, I get that that's what you have to do, but this is a man who straight up got famous off of calling you like essentially a foreign born like Muslim terrorist. Like, you really gonna shake his hand a couple days after? So understanding that we need a better opposition party, I think that's crystallized it completely. We're not out of the woods, but that election was wow.
That would probably be my number six. Trump getting elected. Some of it's worked into my lockdown one, but yeah, huge failure. Massive failure of the Republican Party to weed people out like him, because they thought that they were going to in the primary. And of our society. Like, it's our Americans are awful in many ways, but letting him get elected, even if he didn't win the popular vote, is a failure on more levels than I could probably come up with. But anyway, my number one is one of your previous ones, and it's probably pretty obvious. It's 9/11. Because of my age, if I was 2 years older, it'd probably be the 2000 election, but that was before I was politically awakened, because I was politically awakened by 9/11. It was same as you, it was 2 weeks into my freshman semester. I remember every moment. You know, I lived in a quad, so everyone on the floor basically crammed into our room to watch it in real time as it happened. And suddenly politics mattered. I had not grown up in a political family. I didn't know anything about it. I couldn't have told you if Gore had been the Democrat or the Republican in the previous election. But then it was just demonstrations on campus and everyone was talking about it. I, at that point, was an engineering student. Within a year, I'd switched over to doing political science and suddenly cared about it in a way that my family never encouraged before. I mean, maybe it was inevitable that something would get me into politics, but it's possible that I would have just been writing computer games my whole life or something and not really caring about it. But 9/11 happened and the Patriot Act happened and all this scary stuff in the media and the war, and anybody who opposed it was like exiled effectively. Like, you don't talk about cancel culture. Speak out against the war in the first couple of years.
Absolutely.
But anyway,
Michael Moore gets booed at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Right? He gets booed at the Oscars for winning for Bowling for Columbine. A few years later, everyone loves him. So yeah, Hollywood was all about the war too. Keep going, John.
No. There's not much more. It's like, it's for the ways that it affected everybody. This is not a unique one in any way, but it was huge, and it's still like the some of the worst parts of it we still have. We still like the infrastructure of the Patriot Act, DHS, the wars themselves. We still have all of this. My entire time in politics, from the first moment to as I'm speaking the sentence, we haven't gotten past the majority of that yet. And so there can't be anything bigger than that for me. If I was a little bit older, it'd probably be the 2000 election. An election literally being stolen and then just everybody being like, I guess they stole it.
I made little pins that said ambushed. I wasn't that political, but I wrote like ambush and I like wore it around. I was like, see, we got ambushed. But it wasn't until 9/11 that it was like,
yeah.
They were cute. So,
'cause he had almost a year of his presidency where, like, granted I was young, it's not like a ton of huge stuff was really happening. Like, there was like the spy plane crisis with China that nobody remembers. But like, it seemed like, oh, well, you know, okay, they stole the election, but like, eh.
Bush was a joke. And this is the thing, we are still feeling the ramifications of the Bush administration right now. You're absolutely right, John. I know we have to wrap it up, but member at this point. Although I guess we're only talking to member.
Unless it's pirated. But anyway, this is a tough one. So thank you for doing the self-analysis, putting this together. I appreciate it. And I learned a little bit more about you, and hopefully the audience did too. So everybody watching this, our level 2 and level 3 members, thank you so much for continuing to support us. Hope that you're enjoying these. You can of course always suggest, whether by tweet, responding in the comments to this video, future top 10s that you'd like to see, whether they're political or otherwise. We like both, and we look forward to doing more in the future. So thank you, and bye for now. This week has seen the transition from one presidency to another. There's been a lot of that happening actually with the Senate changing hands as well. We're now getting a healthy dose of Obama era government servants re-entering the service. So what does all of this tell us about what the approach this new administration will have when it comes to the concentration of corporate power, monopolies? What is their approach going to be to this area? Joining us now to help us understand all of this and more is Sarah Miller, the executive director for the American Economic Liberties Project. Sarah, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Glad to have you on. So let's talk about first your organization, the American Economic Liberties Project. What sort of work do you engage in?
Sure. So we're an organization that's oriented around policy development and advocacy that's focused on breaking up economic concentrations of power. So in the short version is we want to break up monopolies and decentralize economic power. And we see that as something that's really central to the progressive vision and progressive framework.
So talk to us about some of the greatest concentrations of corporate power that you generally tend to focus on. Like in terms of political communication recently, thanks to in no small part Donald Trump's focus on it, big tech and their power is something that you hear about quite often. What are some other areas of that concentration that we should be concerned about?
That's a great question. I mean, I think people kind of experience this in their everyday lives. So just to kind of back up a little bit, in the 1980s, President Reagan kind of ushered in this revolution in how antitrust was handled. Antitrust is a set of laws that attempt to kind of decentralize power in the economic sphere and make sure that private monopolies don't become more powerful than the public and overtake democracy. So Reagan kind of threw that out. He was like, no, we want big corporations. We want to get rid of these laws. We don't want to punish success. And Democrats largely embraced that. They largely embraced that same perspective, and that was instrumentalized in policy. And so only over the last couple of years have folks like me and my colleagues and academics and some policymakers stepped back and said, hey, you know, our economy is experiencing all of these structural problems. Donald Trump is president. Society seems in a very fragile place. Democracy seems at risk. There's a number of reasons for that, but part of the kind of cause of all the social dysfunction is the fact that all across the economy, whether it's tech or healthcare or communications in a more traditional sense, or agriculture, is that we have these handful of giant corporations really controlling our commerce in those spaces and then leveraging that into political power through lobbying, electoral campaigns, dark money, et cetera, et cetera. So our goal is to really systemically try to decentralize power in all these critical markets. And I named a few of them, but it's in everywhere from media, you know, as you all well know, to technology, to healthcare, to really niche markets like the cheerleading industry and software. You know, we kind of find it everywhere. You kind of like look into a market, and it's the same dynamic because we haven't been enforcing these sorts of laws for so long, big or small. You know, you usually have a handful of players who are really dominant and who are able to kind of abuse either consumers or workers or kind of competitors and smaller businesses that are trying to gain a foothold in that space as a result. And we don't think that's right.
That's great information. Thank you so much. And I want to talk about you know, some of what you and your organization would like to be done, as well as what you think the Biden administration might do in this area. But before we get to that, you talked about the Reagan era, and since then we've had multiple flips in power, Republicans and Democratic administrations. Is this an area where there has been over those past 30 years or so a significant difference between the parties, or have we generally seen a linear process of corporate accumulation of power regardless of administration?
Yeah, you're right. So in large part, there's been very little difference between Republican and Democratic administrations in the kind of antitrust competition policy space. And they've been like proud of that. They'll say, oh, we carried on the bipartisan tradition of basically doing nothing and approving like tons of mergers and not really enforcing antitrust laws. And that's what's kind of started to change, where you have kind of not only progressives, but also some conservatives, you know, who are saying like, wait a second, you know, this isn't working for us. Like, we need to take a step back here. So I think just over the last 2 years, we've seen the Congress kick into high gear. We've seen even kind of traditional enforcers who previously have rotated through government and kind of the defense bar acknowledge that, you know, we have a real problem with corporate concentration in our hands that's contributing to all of these social harms. arms and that the old ways of doing business were deeply flawed.
So now looking to the future, that makes me wonder. We have these past approaches. We also have a new president who served under one of the previous presidents. You worked in the Treasury Department after the Great Recession, correct?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in what ways are you worried that we're potentially going to be going back to that same sort of Obama template for a fairly hands-off approach to this? Is there, in terms of the staffing choices that you've seen, cabinet level positions, do you have reason to believe that we might be on the cusp of some sort of shift in this policy area?
I think we are going to be on a shift. I think it's a question of how significant of one. So in Congress, we have leadership that's being undertaken by David Cicilline in the House and a number of progressives that have really stepped up to push this issue. Among state attorneys general who have a lot of authority into this space, there are historic antitrust cases against the big tech platforms. So it's happening around them. And I think that the question is whether they will kind of ride that wave and kind of keep it going. And I think there's no doubt that they'll be much better than they were under the Obama years, even if it's a lot of the same enforcers, because I think there's so much more scrutiny and interest and acknowledgement from other kind of people in the economic policy sphere that, it was really quite a kind of catastrophic era. Like I've had people say, were they just asleep at the FTC? Like what was going on? Because it just wasn't on anyone's radar. Like nobody was thinking about it. Nobody was doing really efficient oversight, even within the administration. So I think there's no going back. I think the question is, are we going to move quickly enough and aggressive enough to kind of meet the moment and to address the crisis, in our view, that threatens to kind of undermine democracy, particularly in the context of tech platforms, which we saw very clearly, I think, their role of facilitating radicalization and extremism and then profiting from that during the attack on the Capitol a few weeks ago.
And so let's focus on that area for just a moment, because it's obviously like I said earlier, that's one area where you can get Republicans who talk about like big tech is out of control, they're in league with the Democrats and all of that. Although they don't seem to talk about other massive monopolies in the same way in terms of energy, healthcare, traditional communications, things like that. And I wonder when Trump talks about big tech, he talks mostly about his understanding of Section 230 and all of that. He doesn't, like you were talking about, the facilitation of radicalization, that sort of thing. That's generally not one of the things I see Republicans talking about as evidence that this is a monopoly. And I also don't see them saying, like I believe Elizabeth Warren was a year or two ago, that we should literally be breaking them up. Is this an area where the Republicans being so focused on this means that maybe there could be a bipartisan approach to doing something about that? What might the limits of that be?
Yeah, I'll give you two examples. So there's a number of major antitrust cases actually that are seeking to break up the tech platforms that are bipartisan. So either by the DOJ or by Democratic and Republican state attorneys general. So that is already there. Those entities are calling for breakups as part of the remedies of their cases. And then if you look at the major investigation that the House undertook last year, which was really kind of the first investigation into kind of concentrated corporate power in 50 years. So I think just a really important kind of watershed moment and what Congress needs to be doing more of in the coming years. You saw Republicans kind of sign on to about 75% of the remedies. I don't think they signed on to breakups, but I think now even, and it's obviously for a different set of reasons, that we've kind of seen the ability of the tech platforms to kind of in unison shut down political speech. That just that power over our kind of communications networks online, I think, has probably brought more Republicans into the tech is too big and there's no democratic accountability and who says they can set the rules of who can speak online and who can't. And that's a problem that our democratic institutions need to solve in the same way that we've solved it for the post office and other forms of communications, but not obviously online.
And finally, you said that you want both a quick and aggressive approach to this. What could that look like under Biden? Is it pursuing targeted splitting up of companies? Are there other things that you or the organization would like to see pursued?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can get a little bit wonky here, but one is kind of holding corporations accountable when they break their agreements. So corporations will make an agreement not to do this or not to do that. And because the agencies have been so toothless, they never even hold them accountable or really even look back to see if they're doing it. Someone is like, hold some people accountable. You know, if they break the law, you know, make sure that they know they're not above and are not above the law. I think we want to see them bring big, bold, aggressive antitrust cases. That's another. We want to see them write rules, which they have the authority to do, but they don't, to protect workers in a variety of ways that kind of fall under antitrust laws. So there's just a whole kind of world of policy and a whole giant kind of toolbox of tools that can help promote democracy, that can help give workers more power, that can support small businesses, and that can help communities with their own kind of independent economic development that Democrats have not used since before the Reagan era. So let's pick all those back up again and start putting them into practice. That's our goal.
Okay. And I appreciate you joining us and helping both me and the audience learn a little bit more about this and some of the possibilities in the future. Sarah Miller, Executive Director for the American Economic Liberties Project. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.